I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we're going to be exploring, once again, the subject of the DC blob, that is to say, the bipartisan foreign policy consensus on Capitol Hill in regards to foreign policy. Why do so many in the United States Capitol support military adventurism and foreign interventions overseas, despite the catastrophes of Iraq and Afghanistan? Joining us to answer that question is someone direct from DC, former special assistant to President Ronald Reagan, and Cato Institute senior fellow Doug Bondo, who recently wrote a piece for antiwar.com detailing the newest think tank of the DC blob, the Vandenberg Coalition. We'll be discussing all that and much more on this edition of Parallax Views. And now on to the conversation with Doug Bondo. Washington, D.C., place of stately discourse.
Bare knuckle politics and all other assorted forms of scandal. You want the dirt on the Capitol? Then check out Washington Babylon. Shocking true stories and political sleaze, edited by Ken Silverstein. WashingtonBabylon.com.
Welcome to Parallax Views. Doug Bondo of the Cato Institute, also a regular contributor to antiwar.com, a website this podcast is friendly with. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well. How about yourself?
Pretty good. And I wanted to have you on the program because you recently wrote a piece on a new neoconservative think tank in Washington, D.C. I want to talk about that. But first, I wanted to mention that I recently had retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was the chief of staff under Colin Powell, on my program. And he talked to me about the pro-war bias in D.C. And we even talked about figures like Ben Rhodes, who was involved with the Obama administration, who called this the sort of D.C. blob and were sort of annoyed by it. It seems like there's voices from the libertarian end to even some elements of the Democratic Party that agree on this, that there is a pro-war bias in D.C. So I guess what I want to ask you is, why is there a pro-war bias in D.C.?
It's an interesting question. Part of it is there's a self-selection process, I think, of Washington. You know, this really is kind of the imperial city. And it's tied up with a vision of America, the exceptional nation. So the U.S. has a it's almost anointed from heaven to go solve problems in the world. I think there's also, it mixes with the fact that people want to do things. Yeah, so in a good sense, you come to Washington, you see a problem in the world, you want to solve it. and you're in a system that is focused on doing things. And it's also, frankly, personally rewarding. You know, are you more likely to get invited to conferences if you're saying we should strengthen the alliance with NATO or we should dismantle it? If you're saying that we should help the Saudis out or that we should treat them as they deserve to be treated, I mean, this will have a major impact on whether you go to conferences, what your future employment opportunities will be, whether your think tank will get, you know, money. I mean, you know, who funds many of the think tanks? It's the merchants of death. It's foreign governments. You know, Cato doesn't take any governmental money, even from the U.S. government, but it's very common. And, you know, it's not so much that people are being bought. I think it's a sense of there's a mutual interest there that develops and becomes self-reinforcing. So you put all of that together. You know, the people are in kind of the hinterland of America, have a lot of things on their mind. Normally, solving the world's problems is not topmost. People who come to Washington in international affairs, I think that is very, very important for them, and everything else reinforces it.
I'm glad that you mentioned Cato, because I'm going to have some listeners on the sort of progressive end of the political spectrum that are inevitably going to mention, oh, isn't that funded by Charles Koch? And, you know, I think a lot of people have taken this follow the money thing into the wrong direction. I think it's important to look at how foundations and think tanks, including this new neocon think tank, who funds them, where the money comes from. But at the same time, I think someone like Charles Koch has actually been very much devoted to pro-peace, anti-war stances, and also things like prison reform. So even if I disagree with a libertarian like Charles Koch on, you know, some issues very profoundly, I think progressives and libertarians, even conservatives, can come together on issues like foreign policy, prison reform, et cetera, et cetera. And I wanted to get your take on that.
No, my view is that progressives never really understood Charles or David, his late brother who from New York, who died a couple of years ago. I mean, you can go back 30 years and they were supporting a group called Students for a Libertarian Society that in a sense was a takeoff of SDS, Students for a Democratic Society, and being a very activist youthful organization. SLS was very supportive of gay rights, you know, very anti-war, anti-draft registration. And the Koch supported that. The Koch supported Inquiry magazine that I edited. I mean, we had a lot of people on the left, very clearly on the left, writing for us on foreign policy. And in recent years, they've always been in favor of gay rights. They've been a supporter of gay marriage. They were very much, you mentioned, prison reform. That was a very high agenda item. And they've always been very non-interventionist in their foreign policy views. They got a lot of attention for their economic work. You know, they had it's the largest privately held oil company in America. You know, so obviously they're involved in that. But especially in recent years, Charles has gotten very, very involved in the peace effort. And his foundation has supported a lot of these groups. Quincy, he went in with Soros to support the Quincy Institute. You know, money goes to Cato, but they've also set up centers. Catholic University has a center that has people there who are kind of realist in a good sense, very rather non-interventionist, very skeptical of this constant war everywhere against everyone. So I think they've been a very, very positive source. So I would simply tell progressives, you know, these are important issues we can work together on. If we don't work together on it, we're going to lose. I mean, the problem is the array of interests against us is very, very significant. So my hope is that we can work together. Quincy, I think, has been a very good example of bringing, let's face it, Soros, Republicans and conservatives get freaked out over him in the same way that many progressives get freaked out over the Kochs. You know, that tells me he's probably doing something worthwhile if he's getting so many people upset.
Well, I was going to add to that as well. I think a lot of times people can get too conspiratorial when talking about any kind of think tank and the funding coming from those think tanks. And I even think that's true of these neocon think tanks in a sense, because I get the impression that the Samantha Powers and Robert Kagans of the world, I think they really do believe in what they're saying. It's just a matter of we, people like us, think that they are really, really on the wrong track.
No, I think that's right. I mean, I argued back with the Iraq invasion, which I and Cato vociferously opposed. I mean, conservative publications stopped running my articles and, I had entire archives that were wiped out because they had anti-war articles in them. However, I thought it was a mistake to say, well, this is just because that Cheney you know, and his company or something, and they're making profits. No, I mean, I think that these folks believe very much in their vision. And they really did believe that this was going to, you know, drain the swamp, as they said. You know, it'd solve all these problems. Everybody would be singing Kumbaya, and, you know, great things would happen in the Middle East. They turned out to be recklessly wrong. But I think it's, if you want to defeat them, we have to take on their strongest arguments and defeat those arguments. Simply trying to attack them as individuals and motivations, I don't think work. I think most people usually take them at their word. And I think for the most part, most of them actually do believe this. There may be financial interests that come along. But again, Washington is a place where it's easy. And it's not just in foreign policy. It's very easy to believe what you are doing is for the public interest. And by the way, it's helpful for you too. And it's great when the two come together. And for a lot of people, I think that's, it's very naturally that it comes together.
Do you think also that there's maybe an issue where people in the Beltway are disconnected from maybe the broader populace and their feelings on things? Because I think you have a lot of people in DC, a lot of people would say the elites, right, that really believe that the US has to be the sort of global policeman. And I increasingly see that people in the broader populace are really not down with that mindset.
I think that the sense in Washington is the American people are wonderful, but they don't pay attention. So in a sense, what they think doesn't matter very much. That if they did pay attention and listen to what was going on, then they would realize that they had to do all these things. Frederick Kagan had kind of an extraordinary article recently where, in essence, he's one of the prime neocons with the vision of running the world.
Do you mean Robert Kagan?
I guess, right. I'm sorry.
Yeah, he had a piece in, I think it was Foreign Policy or Foreign Affairs. Yeah.
I mean, and it was really obnoxious, but it was of the sort that the American people are tired and they just need to suck it up, that we have to do this. Otherwise, the world will end and there'll be a new dark ages descending or something. But I think that in many ways, that is the hard edge of what many of these people believe. I mean, Madeleine Albright has made a number of these statements that are kind of, you know, beyond belief, you know, 500,000 dead Iraqi babies. Well, we think the price is worth it. I mean, one of her other statements was, we stand taller, we see further. That is Americans. And I think when she said we, it really wasn't so much Americans as the blob, members of the blob. You know, we see further into the future. We realize what has to be done. So all of these other people are very nice, but they, you know, it's not their decision to make. And I think that's the way they look at it. They believe they are acting on behalf of the American people, and it is their duty to act on their behalf, even if at that moment the American people may not like what they're doing.
Could we stick on that concept of the blob briefly here? Because I think it's a really perfect term. And I think sometimes I've used the term a lot on this show, but sometimes I think it's good to maybe lay out for newer listeners what exactly it is. How would you describe the sort of DC blob?
Well, there's a number of kind of, and to some degree, it actually reaches to New York, and you could argue, you know, a bit to say Chicago and LA, because there are global affairs councils and other sorts of things, you know, floating around, that there are clearly some centers of international interest and tend to be interventionist in other places, but very heavily Washington because of, you know, the political center. And New York has, you know, the Council on Foreign Relations and a number of other organizations of this sort as well. I mean, the starting point would be policymakers themselves, that is, legislators, people in government, staff members of the Hill, you know, people who do have a role directly in legislating on or acting, making these decisions. Then there's a broader group. In a sense, it's the world from which they tend to be drawn, very heavily think tank, other international organizations. You know, they could be at international law firms, you know, international companies, trade, you know, firms, consulting firms. There's a whole pile of that. And a lot of these are think tanks. I mean, that's, you know, you look at, say, Atlantic Council and Brookings and CSIS, AEI. I mean, a real churning there of people who go in and out of government, and they're all partisan. I mean, most of these think tanks have a partisan identification, some not. I mean, AEI, you know, Republicans will show up there. I think John Bolton is now at AEI. Or, you know, Hudson. Hudson is a very conservative place. You know, so these would all be. You'd also certainly reach out to media and commentators, columnists. I mean, you think of a Tom Friedman. I mean, these are people who have very influential positions to speak from, to influence, you know, to have an impact on people. You know, so I'd be looking at kind of that in a broad sense as being what I think of as the blob of policymakers, potential policymakers and those who influence policymakers, in a sense. So the, and it's a fairly large number of people, you know, but they talk very much to one another. I've been, you know, after with the pandemic, I've been watching a lot of webinars as I do emails and other sorts of things. And what, you know, what is amazing, I mean, it doesn't matter what the issue is, essentially every webinar of almost every think tank, and I mean, Cato's not there, Quincy isn't there, but is we must strengthen relations with, you know, fill in the country. We must tighten relations. We must do more. We need to have more troops there. We have to do more to solve the problem. Consistent refrain. And everybody has everybody else's personnel on, and everybody has somebody as a moderator who's often a journalist or as a the policymaker. You know, they have ambassadors on, or they have, you know, political people on who are willing to be interviewed. You know, so it's very, I mean, it really is incestuous. They talk to one another. They reinforce their own views.
So that brings us to the Vandenberg Coalition, which Elliot Abrams last week, I believe, or a few weeks ago, penned an op-ed celebrating its creation. And Abrams, for those unfamiliar, famously participated in the Iran-Contra scandal, and I believe was a never-Trumper who actually served under Trump.
Yes.
Let's talk about Elliot Abrams and the Vandenberg Coalition.
Well, he's certainly a good example. I mean, this is somebody who worked for Reagan. He was, I think he was the Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights. You know, I mean, there's a lot of criticism of what he did in Latin America. He seemed to be more supportive of the dictatorships than the people. I mean, so some of these things do get messy. You have an ugly dictatorship and it's being threatened by an ugly communist insurgency. What do? You know, I mean, it's kind of the World War II example. Do you fight with the Nazis? Do you fight with the Soviets? Nevertheless, he certainly earned scorn in that regard. And then he got tied up in the Iran-Contra affair. I think he ended up being convicted of misleading Congress. He was, I think, Bush, it was H.W. pardoned him. He got a pardon along the way from one of the Republican presidents, went off to a conservative-minded think tank, and has a lot of clout within kind of the neoconservative community. I mean, he knows these people all know each other. You know, Irving Kristol or Bill Kristol and others, you all have worked together and been connected. And then he was proposed by Tillerson to be the Deputy Secretary of State. And when Trump was running for office, he signed one of those Never Trump letters, you know, which, I mean, not only saying this, you shouldn't vote for this guy, but basically denouncing his character and everything else. And say what you will about Donald Trump, somebody must have brought it to his attention. He killed nixed that as an appointment. But then I think he let Pompeo do what he wanted. Pompeo chose Abrams to be the guy, the point person. He was the point person on Venezuela, and then he picked up Iran after they, you know, pushed Hook or whatever aside. So he ended up in charge of two places where many of us thought that the president really wanted to actually go to war. You know, thankfully he didn't want to go to war elsewhere, but those are two places he talked about it. Needless to say, you know, Abrams didn't come out, you know, having succeeded at anything, but he's back at a think tank now doing his usual shtick, presumably waiting for, you know, 4 years from now, hoping that Pompeo becomes president.
So before we talk more about the Vandenberg Coalition, I also wanted to draw this point out, since Abrams was involved playing a role in things like Venezuela under Trump. I was wondering, as a libertarian, what is your view on matters related to the U.S. and, say, a government like Venezuela? Because I think sometimes progressives are surprised to find out that libertarians and even some conservatives feel that we should not be interfering in countries like Venezuela and their politics.
Yeah, I think our involvement there is catastrophic. I am not at all a fan of Hugo Chavez or Maduro. But I mean, number one is the U.S. has gotten itself in trouble. And part of it's out of the old anti-communist past, is we would embrace regimes which were kind of, quote, conservative, whatever that meant, you know, in that society, which also were kleptocratic, you know, which were brutal, authoritarian, and the whole schmear. You know, so, you know, the U.S. government would end up supporting these truly awful regimes, you know, and they would be embraced and people would talk them up, and it would sound like this is a kind of a conservative or libertarian vision. Yeah, it's certainly not. And my view is that, you know, you don't want to get into regime change stuff. I think that Chavez was a real problem. I do think he was an authoritarian. But the U.S. so rarely can improve those situations. And then when we get into a situation, I mean, we backed the coup way back when against Chavez, which got knocked off and he came back to power. And then, of course, sanctions policy, where we go out of our way to ruin the economy. And now we're literally trying to starve people who are already starving. You know, I think it's just utterly outrageous. I think the administration, the Trump administration was awful. I mean, the bone killing, bone crunching sanctions on Venezuela, retracting some of the improvements that Obama made. Obama made in Cuba. I went to Cuba 4 years ago. People still had stickers with Obama's face on their cars. People I talked to, journalists and others, would talk about how what really threatened the Cuban regime was Obama. That is, he was opening up. He went there. They loved him. That just shows how engagement is much more hopeful and a better way of empowering people than this. I mean, we're currently starving people in Syria because they actually believe that'll cause, a power change. Assad's not going to give up power now, but they're starving people anyway. Iran, of course, North Korea, all of these have those characteristics, which I think are a huge, huge mistake.
I was going to mention as well in that regard. I mean, when we look at a place like Iran, it seems really backwards to me to suggest, we can just apply sanctions to this country, which will end up punishing the Iranian people, and that'll change everything. Because to me, that can run the risk of actually heightening nationalism in a country.
Yeah, there's a real difficulty in getting policymakers to kind of flip things around, and how would they respond to the same tactic? If China was in a position to starve Americans, would that make us more or less sympathetic with the objectives of the Chinese government? It's the same thing, dropping drones. If my neighbor's house disappeared in a drone strike, am I going to listen to the country that dropped the drone and believe them when they say, he was a terrorist, sorry, we had to do that, too bad your kid was out in the front yard and got incinerated? Even with China, even kind of geopolitics, if I tell people that, imagine if the Soviets had invited Mexico to join NATO, or if the Chinese Navy was steaming up the East Coast. We need to be able to position ourselves, kind of strategic empathy, that is what people typically term it. I think that we are so completely blind to that. Part of it is cruel. That is, part of it is an assumption. If we really crush the people, then maybe they'll overthrow the people we don't like. And to me, that's the most callous, the most cruel. I'm going to try to starve you so you do politically what I want you to do. I mean, there's a point. I mean, interest matters in foreign policy, but it certainly has to be bounded by a sense of moral conception. There are certain things you don't do. And that strikes me as one of them, where you impoverish an entire society, in pursuit of some foreign policy goal.
It's funny too, because I feel like some of these, I'll just say sort of pro-war bipartisan war party think tanks, I think they would accuse people like us or people at the Quincy Institute of being isolationists. Whereas I think we're just for sort of a realistic foreign policy that understands the necessity of restraint.
I think that's exactly right. I tell people that, I'm an internationalist. I mean, I believe in trade. I believe in, commerce. I believe in cultural exchange. I believe in tourism. I mean, the most interesting thing I do is I travel. I've been to North Korea twice. I've been to Cuba twice. I've been to Syria. I went there like 3 years ago. I mean, I've been to both North and South Cyprus. I mean, I've been to China more than any other country. I've been there more than 20 times. I was trying to count at one point, remembering trips I've taken. But I've been to Taiwan as well. I mean, for me, if you want to understand the world, and I find it endlessly fascinating. So I'm not an isolationist. My view is that internationalism is not best represented by bombing people. I mean, what the U.S. government is known for is bombing, invading, and occupying. People in other countries tend to love Americans for lots of good reasons. They typically don't like the U.S. government. And I get very frustrated. This isolationism is thrown out there when it has nothing to do with the positions that we take. We actually embrace the world in a way that I would argue in many ways they don't. I mean, they embrace it to the extent they do in a very hostile fashion, a very coercive fashion. We try a very different tactic.
Now, with regards to the Vandenberg Coalition, I believe it's named after a senator, Arthur Vandenberg.
Yeah.
Okay, could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Arthur Vandenberg, during kind of the lead up to World War II, and you know, was what was then called an isolationist. And again, even then, it was a slur word. I mean, typically the isolationists weren't isolationists. I mean, the pre-World War II Republican administrations were very active diplomatically. That you know, the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which people joke about, it's the treaty that outlaws war, which unfortunately has no enforcement mechanism. But Kellogg was a Republican Secretary of State, one of the authors of that pact. You know, so Republicans were actually very active around the world. I mean, Hoover, you know, had in World War I had helped feed people, and after the war, you know, organized feeding with Russia and with Europe. You know, so even people like Vandenberg really weren't isolationists, but they were very skeptical of the use of American power abroad. He changed position, you know, after World War II, and it was a very dramatic switch, and it helped bring along other Republicans. So it really expanded the Cold War coalition, and it was very much in the times. It's coming out of World War II, that hideous conflict, dealing with the Soviet Union. So they are looking at him as kind of the archetypal, you know, interventionist, and he was a Republican. And that, I think, is why most of these people who are on that, I suspect, are Republicans. And it looked to me like they were really responding out of fear that there are a fair number of Trump supporters who are less inclined to go to war. That Trump, for all of his failures, which were many, he really didn't want to go to war. I mean, he backed away constantly, thankfully, like attacking Iran, and he, you know, trying to get U.S. troops out of Afghanistan. I mean, his unique failures and his lack of the ability or the temperament for the job, you know, he failed at those things. Nevertheless, the neoconservatives were very frustrated because they saw all these opportunities for war. He didn't take them. So I think the Vandenberg coalition, this is the attempt to say the real Republicans, you know, are for this. And we have this vision that to try to bring other Republicans along to.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that there seems to be this fear or maybe a changing of the tide that is maybe bothering people like a Robert Kagan. I said that when I read his recent op-ed that you had mentioned, that, you know, it seems like he's having a temper tantrum. And then I think about Samantha Power, who you mentioned in your May 3rd antiwar.com piece, expressing just irritation over how dare these people complain about the disaster of the Iraq war. We have important things to do. How dare they keep attacking us for this? It seems like these sort of pro-war elements are becoming a little bit more defensive. Maybe the tide is turning slightly. I don't know.
I think they are embarrassed. And part of it is, I mean, the disaster of Iraq is so great that even though I'm still amazed at how few of them will admit that it was a mistake, they at least recognize most everybody else thinks it's a mistake. And of course, they've just piled disaster on disaster. We have 10 years of civil war, you know, out of Libya. And of course, that's the war where we took out the dictator who had given up his nukes and his missiles. So, I mean, you just think of the precedent we've set now. What serious dictator anywhere will give those up, knowing that you might end up, you know, I mean, I tell people, if you want to see how he ended up, you can go on YouTube. It was a very, very unpleasant end, not one that anyone would want, you know, to have happen to them. And that's, you know, the message we sent. And then throw on top of that Yemen. I mean, to have people talking about humanitarian intervention when we're engaged with a vile dictatorial regime that's, you know, I mean, committing murder and mayhem. Millions of people with cholera and disease, and 80% of the population needs support and this malnutrition and stuff. I mean, so I think that this interventionist coalition, they try to explain all of it away and they try to ignore it, but they know it's out there. And I do think they're nervous because they, and Trump, you know, again, they're looking at this strange guy who really seemed to represent something, and they're very worried where it's going.
Another interesting aspect of all of this, and I'm not sure how some of these war party elements justify in their head, maybe you would have some insight on it, is there's a lot of talk. I've even heard Secretary Blinken say, you know, we believe in these American values and we're going to champion these American values across the world. But at the same time, we support the tyranny of some very, you know, oppressive regimes. I mean, we look at Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt. You mentioned all of these in the article. Why is that? Why is there that sort of disconnect between the two, the stated values and how we support some of these really oppressive regimes?
You know, I mean, the challenge for us is the world is a messy place. So, and to me, in many ways, World War II is kind of the archetype, the ultimate. And, you know, you have to be careful pointing to it all the time, but I do think it shows the problem. What do you do when the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany are, you know, fighting? And the outcome is likely to be one of them will dominate Eurasia. And it's like, oh my God, now what do we do? And I think we did the right thing. That is, at that moment, Nazi Germany was the more aggressive, dangerous power that did have expansionist designs, et cetera. So, we probably had to get involved. And if we got involved, that was, I mean, almost certainly the side to have gotten involved in. And then I do believe, at least in the early years, we had to provide a protective shield for Europe. I just don't think we have to be there now. I mean, 75 years later, you know, can't the Europeans do this? So I think the problem is that people take that and then apply it to a lot of situations where it's not nearly as dire. I mean, we did this throughout the Cold War. I mean, we supported some really rotten regimes. I mean, Latin America. I mean, why is Somoza our guy? Well, he's anti-communist. Why was the Shah our guy? Well, he's anti-communist or something. I mean, you know, why did we help overthrow the Mossadegh? Well, because he was getting, the oil and we were worried about what, all this stuff. It's all this kind of national interest stuff thrown out there without a lot of concern for the consequences. In some of these cases, in many ways, you're not choosing between authoritarian and democratic. You're choosing between, two different authoritarians. But it strikes me that number one is we should make that choice as seldom as possible, as opposed to routinely make it. Second is we really need to think about what's at stake. Why are we supporting a really monstrous regime in Egypt? Well, because we're worried about something. I'm not sure what that something is. Nobody believes Egypt's going to go to war with Israel. And if we didn't support, Morsi, what would happen? Well, I mean, I have trouble imagining, that ISIS will take control. I mean, but we are linked with a regime that's even worse than the Mubarak regime. I visited there twice with the lawyers group back in, I think it was 2015. I doubt they'd let me in now. I mean, it was bad enough then, and just talking to the people, their kids had been dragged off and disappeared and arrested for all sorts of stuff. I mean, the torture, we talked with the anti-torture center, where the person running it, it had been open under Mubarak. And a couple of years ago, the government shut them down. I mean, we didn't say anything because Trump's comment on al-Sisi was, he's my favorite dictator. And, Pompeo goes out and talks about Iranian human rights violations, which are very real. And then he flies to Riyadh and, plays kissy-kissy with, Mohammed bin Salman, who's, slices and dices opponents, at a consulate and arrests all the women activists who are promoting women's rights and everything. It's a huge stain. It undercuts our message. It makes us, it's bad enough to be hypocritical, but when you're sanctimonious about it and don't even seem to acknowledge and realize what you're doing, I think it's very problematic. But, look, the Biden administration's run into that as well. They said they'd make Mohammed bin Salman a pariah. I mean, on the good, they've at least reduced U.S. support for operations in Yemen. And they released the report on his role in the Khashoggi murder. But they also decided not to go any further. And they essentially said, well, we got to do business with them. It's a very, very real problem. We promote our ideals and then we constantly undercut those ideals. It really hurts our message.
Well, I think the really important aspect when we look at things like the Vandenberg Coalition is there's all this talk of we need these kind of think tanks because they strengthen our nation and protect Americans. And I don't think anyone can disagree with the idea of, that would be great to strengthen our nation and protect our fellow citizens. But I feel as if the Vandenberg Coalition and these other sort of pro-war think tanks actually may be doing the opposite. I think in some ways we see things like blowback from some of the foreign policy decisions made in recent decades. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Well, there's no question that there's blowback. The interventionists always hate to admit that, but there's really no doubt. I mean, the simplest analogy is if you go out and hit a hornet's nest, you're probably going to get stung. I mean, the notion that if you get into something that, you know, everybody's going to view you as being a Vestal Virgin, kind of acting on behalf of mankind, is just nonsensical. I mean, Ronald Reagan, who, I mean, I respect, I didn't, you know, I mean, he was much more hawkish. When I left, I worked there for, you know, a year and a half. And when I left, my foreign policy views were always much more libertarian. And I wrote about it and earned some enmity from former colleagues. But for example, in Lebanon, I mean, we got involved in the middle of a civil war. I mean, it was terrible. But what we were doing in the middle of a civil war, why was the Marine Corps barracks blown up? It's because we were involved fighting essentially on behalf of what was at best the government of Lebanon, of Beirut, even though it claimed to be the government of Lebanon. We were bombarding Muslim villages and Druze villages. And you can read old New York Times stories about the USS New Jersey sitting offshore bombarding. We, you know, and we were also doing airstrikes. So, you know, locals viewed the U.S. as fair game. I mean, and so I wouldn't even call that terrorism. I mean, they were, it's an act of war. They viewed us as being in the war. And terrorism is basically the poor man's way of fighting. That is, if you don't have all the military assets the U.S. does, you look for other ways, you know, to strike back. And it's tragic, you know, that we had the guy from Pakistan. He was a Pakistani-American who tried to set off the bomb in Times Square. You know, and they, you know, I mean, luckily the bomb didn't go off, and he waited around a couple of weeks long enough for them to figure out who he was, and they arrested him on the plane as he was about to fly to Pakistan. And in court, the judge asked him, well, why did you do this? And he said, well, you know, the U.S. government kind of does all these things against, you know, Muslims around the world. So my view is it's a war. And the judge says, well, but these are civilians. These are, you know, people in Times Square. And his response was, well, the U.S. government doesn't care. I mean, it kills anybody that it wants. And I mean, that doesn't justify terrorism, but it helps explain it, which is if you get in the middle of these things, and if you appear, you know, if you appear to be wantonly involved in, you know, committing murder and mayhem, people will fight back. So my view is we have to take that in. Number one, we have to take that into account, that it's a good practical reason to be cautious of things that we should have moral compunction about anyway. You know, and the second is that if you're thinking about an anti-terrorism policy, it's not enough to just figure, well, we'll just kill the bad guys. What we need to do is stop making enemies. So let's think of a foreign policy that reduces the likelihood that people will hate us and want to kill us. You know, this is that we can't act as if we're innocents in this. Unfortunately, our policies have contributed to it. And I worry, you know, if we have terrorists from Yemen, it's going to be hard to complain. I mean, people there talk about the Saudi-American war. You know, they can look at bombs that don't explode, and they can see the U.S. You know, writing on them and serial numbers and stuff. You know, we put ourselves in the middle of that conflict for 6 years, helping Saudis kill a lot of civilians.
There were just one or two more things I wanted to ask you about and get your insights on. The first is you mentioned that you've been to various different countries and interacted with their cultures. Sometimes I feel as if, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, I feel as if the foreign policy world, especially the very pro-interventionist, pro-war foreign policy world, doesn't consider the culture and the mores and the differences between maybe Western culture and, say, culture in Afghanistan, and how there's different groups in Afghanistan. Do you think that has also led to problems when it comes to foreign policy?
Yes. Now, I mean, there are a lot of people in Washington who understand, you know, those cultures. They tend not to be the ones making the decisions. And very often, those making the decisions just don't, you know, aren't interested enough, don't spend the time. That look, I mean, if you're the president of the United States, you're supposed to make decisions on all this stuff. You know, so how likely is it that you're going to actually know an awful lot about any of these places? But I think there's also mixed with this, again, is a sense of American exceptionalism, a sense of universal values. And I do believe that there's kind of life and dignity are universal values, but that doesn't mean cultures are. It doesn't mean the exact expressions, you know, the kind of the, you know, how a community, you know, responds, how a community kind of supports and promotes these values is the same. And even if you don't like the values and the culture, you have to take it into account because it's going to have an impact on what you want to do. I mean, you look at Afghanistan. I mean, it's a tragic place. I mean, there are a lot of, I mean, I was there twice about 10 years ago. Lots of wonderful people there who really want a liberal society of the sort that we like, but, you know, we can't give it to them. And this is a country, it's the idea of a unitary government out of Kabul never made sense. It's governed by the village and the valley. I mean, it's a very, very, ethnicities matter, tribes matter. I mean, all of this stuff is hugely important. And you talk to people, Americans go there and have virtually no contact with any Afghans except those who are working for them. So they have so troops, people who are trained in war are kind of stuck being the local representatives trying to meet with local tribal leaders. American political leaders won't venture out of the U.S. embassy. I mean, a couple of years ago, I have a friend who was over there who told me that they no longer use the roads to get from the embassy to the airport. Well, that's after almost 20 years. I mean, that tells you you've lost. When I was there, we took the roads. We were careful. We didn't make a big show of it. But we took the roads. So I think that that's a huge problem, is that we dismiss those. I mean, again, Madeleine Albright's comment, we see further. I mean, the idea of 500,000 babies dying. Well, we think the price is worth it. What gives us the right? Well, we have this far seeing. We understand the bigger problem. We know what's right for these people, that kind of a thing. If you look at the Balkans, we insist on maintaining multi-ethnic states when it would certainly appear that often the people don't want them. I mean, well, why does that make sense? I mean, I understand kind of the theory behind that they should be willing to live together, but what if they aren't? Practically, wouldn't it be better to follow what they want than what we want? So I do think that's a very real problem. We need to have a much better understanding. Look, what this really calls for is humility, that we are not we are not all-knowing. We are not in a position to wander around the world as social engineers, ignoring history and tradition, religion, geography. I mean, you just think about parachuting into these places, and almost always our policymakers meet with their policymakers in the capital. So we talk to the English speakers in the capital. We don't get out to the rural lands. We don't talk to people in traditional society. We don't understand what their country is really about. Imagine if somebody comes to America, they only go to Washington or New York, and they never go anywhere else. Well, they've seen an important part of America, but boy, they've missed a heck of a lot of it.
So the last thing I wanted to ask you about, and this is a bit of a two-part question, I wanted to get your thoughts on President Joe Biden's ordering a withdrawal from Afghanistan after 20 years of nation building in that country. But first, one thing that has frustrated me with some of the pushback I've seen in mainstream media against Biden's order for a withdrawal is I have seen articles saying, what if this creates a situation where it could harm America in the future? What if there's terror attacks? And I think to myself, what about the people of Afghanistan? Shouldn't we be thinking about them? Because I'm going to be honest, I think when we leave, it's going to be a very difficult time in Afghanistan. And I don't think people should downplay that. I wanted to get your thoughts on that and just more generally on the order for withdrawal and what you think it means going forward.
Well, I think it's going to be awful. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean the Taliban wins everything. I mean, the Soviet-backed regime lasted about 4 years after they pulled out, and I think it collapsed only when the Soviets finally stopped sending money. So there could be a certain resilience. I mean, part of this, what's going on in Afghanistan is, it's ethnic. I mean, for the most part, the Taliban is Pashtun. And an awful lot of the ANA, Afghan National Army, and the police are Hazaris, they're Uzbeks, they're Tajiks. They'll be around. I mean, they were fighting the Taliban when we got involved. They were the initial part of the force that we worked with. Look, the place has changed a lot in 20 years. I mean, there is a very real urban elite and everything. I could imagine that it's settling out at some point where, in essence, you have cities ruled, and some, a bit of land ruled by whatever the government is, whatever you want to call it, where much of the rural, country that's Pashtun will be held by the Taliban. We don't really know how it's all going to settle out. I do think it's going to be rough, and my guess is the war will continue, and it's going to be really tough for liberal elements. I mean, women who I met there, this is 10 years ago, but very, very concerned about the future, and they're right to be. And I think you're right, we shouldn't dismiss this. The problem is, would anyone say we should go to Central Asia to create a democracy in Afghanistan if we weren't there now? And I think you'd be laughed away. I mean, people would say, what are you talking about? Right? I mean, what if I proposed, it's time we dealt with Kyrgyzstan? Or do you realize that Tajikistan is one of the Tajikistan, I think Turkmenistan is probably the worst of the stands. I mean, Turkmenistan may be the absolute worst. It gets close to North Korea levels of oppression. It's time we went there and fixed that and created democracy in Turkmenistan. I think people would look at you like you had three heads. So what we have to realize is that we can't let inertia, kind of keep us there. And the argument about, this will lead to terrorism, I think is just ridiculous. Number one, Afghanistan itself is not unique to terrorism. That simply was where bin Laden was because he went there to fight the Soviets. And for the most part, 9/11 wasn't planned there. I mean, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the planner, refused to move there. I mean, bin Laden wanted him to go there. He wouldn't. I mean, the planning was done around the world. I mean, there were Filipinos who thought about this as a plot, folks in America doing the training. And there are lots of spots in the world, kind of ungoverned spots. I mean, until recently, I mean, Yemen was the big problem area for Al-Qaeda. And our war there has actually made it a bigger problem because the Houthis are actually anti-Al-Qaeda. So we made it more difficult for them to have their traditional fights against Al-Qaeda.
I was going to add to that briefly, too. I think the U.S. intervention has actually hurt Afghanistan in some ways. I mean, we look at the U.S.-backed figures there, like Karzai in the past, and they haven't always been great for that country or its people.
Oh, exactly. I mean, the problem, look, if you wander in and you want to put somebody in power, again, it comes back to, how much do you actually know? I mean, and what's your incentive? Who's best for you versus who might be best for Afghans? We got very unhappy with Karzai near the end, but that's because he was more independent and he wasn't doing what we wanted. Well, he may have been doing what the Afghans wanted. It's very, reaching into another society and playing social engineer is extraordinarily difficult to do well. And we have a lot of examples of not doing it well.
And just that last point, the second part of my question, and then I promise to let you go because I kept you a little bit over time and I appreciate that. What do you think that this withdrawal means? Some of the things Biden has said about it, including, the Afghan people have to sort of make their own future. We can't force our vision of the future on them. He said something along those lines. I'm paraphrasing. What do you think about this announcement and what has come with it? Do you think it means there could be a sea change in the future?
Well, it certainly looked like this is one of those issues where, as far as we can tell, Biden has long thought this. That, there was a famous, he had an explosion, back during the Obama, where he was, can't remember if it was Richard Holbrooke, I think maybe Richard Holbrooke, who he kind of exploded against about why my son should be going to Afghanistan. And he was famously against the increases that Obama made. So this, I think, Biden has always been very much an interventionist in a broad sense. I mean, he voted for Iraq, but I think he's had some qualms about how badly that turned out. Afghanistan looks to me like one where he really read right, that, it's one thing to go in initially to try to destroy Al-Qaeda and to punish the Taliban and send a message, you don't host these people. But the idea of sticking around for 10 or 20 years to fix the place, I think he understood was just well beyond, what we needed. And so I'm hopeful that that will have an impact elsewhere. I worry about Syria, for example, that they'll double down there. I mean, we're occupying a third of the country. We're in a bizarre position where we're facing off against Syrians, Russians, Iranians, Turks. For reasons that are kind of escape me, the idea that we can fix, Syria, I think is just very, very unlikely. And the Caesar sanctions, for the most part, are starving people who are already in great need, which I don't see how that in any way is going to solve the problem. And I'm not sure if there's much interest on their part in fixing that. The problem is they were involved in the whole Syrian decisions with Obama. So a lot of them, I think, feel guilty the way it turned out. But I'm hopeful that Biden so far seems to have been rather restrained. I mean, there are big issues like China I worry a little bit more about, because there you could have a real war. And so far he's taking a much more kind of hawkish and confrontational position. And I think that could prove to be very dangerous. And we'll see what happens with Russia. I have the same view there. Nuclear are in power. You want to be very careful, and how you work that stuff out. It's not easy, but it's essential you do work it out.
Do you think, though, that maybe the announcement of the withdrawal, and assuming it's fully followed through on, does this maybe create an opening for places like Cato and the Quincy Institute to maybe gain a little bit of influence to say, hey, maybe we were right about this one? Do you think that it creates an opening for those of us who are really questioning these sort of dominant modes of foreign policy in the U.S.?
Well, we certainly should use it as an opening. you know, the other side really, really doesn't want to let us in. I mean, it's extraordinary how close they want it to be. I don't know if you saw, the Atlantic Council has hired a couple of my former colleagues at Cato, and one of them and plus somebody who was already there put up a paper that suggested having a bit more flexibility in dealing with Russia. And 22 Atlantic Council people put on their website a criticism denouncing them. And Politico did a story and quoted people, and the quotes were absolutely vicious. You know, so it's obvious that the folks don't want to allow an opening, but I think you're right that if it appears we're being listened to, that might very, what it might very well do is convince think tanks and others, now you have to start dealing with these people. We need maybe have somebody on our staff who deals on these issues. We should engage them more. So that would certainly be a good result. It's going to be long-term, but I'd love to see that.
Well, and of course, I don't think we're going away either. You know, as much as they may want the Quincy Institute to go away, you know, the Beltway, it's not going away. We're not going away. Exactly. So exactly. I want to thank you, Doug Bondow, for coming on Parallax Views.
Very happy to do so.
And how can my listeners keep up with your work?
Well, Cato.org puts up most of my stuff. I have a twice a week column with antiwar.com, which I think people there would like. That includes the piece on the blob that you mentioned. I do a weekly column for American Conservative, much the same vein. Despite the name, progressives, I think, would enjoy a certain amount that's up on that website and in that magazine. They've always been anti-interventionist. I wrote against the Iraq War going back, you know, to 2003. So they've been at this for quite some time. And I write for, you know, for the most part, anyone else who's willing to, you know, publish me, I'm happy to go on. You know, I've been on liberal and progressive websites before. I have better contacts on the right. But wherever I write about foreign policy, it's non-interventionist. And again, Cato website kind of has everything, but there's a lot of great stuff on antiwar.com. So I'd certainly encourage people to go there, not only to read me, but to read Danny Scherson and my colleague, Ted Carpenter, and Dan Larison is now there, who's done great work on American Conservatives. So there's a bunch of good people worth reading.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Doug Bondow. I know a lot of my listeners come from the more progressive or left-wing end of the political spectrum, and I would say that's true of myself as well. But I think that Doug provides some insights that are very useful to left-wing critics of the current dominant mode of U.S. foreign policy, and I hope you got something out of our conversation. I think sometimes it's important to reach across the table and have these discussions with people we may not always agree with. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Ben, Brian, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.